Before we get into today's episode, we want to let you know there are descriptions of racial violence in our story.
The inciting incident we're going to talk about today took place in Greensboro, North Carolina. It was November 3rd, 1979, when the KKK shot and killed five people in Greensboro.
This happened during a protest.
Over the span of 88 seconds, the Klan and Nazis shot dead five anti-racist activists who were members of the Communist Workers' Party. 10 other activists were injured. No one was convicted in the massacre, but a jury did find the Greensboro police liable for cooperating with Ku Klux Klan in a wrongful death.
This scene was permanently burned into the consciousness of my little girls. And when I hear establishment apologists with glib arrogance promote the absolutely false view that I planned a shootout and then tricked the police, my blood boils as my soul rages.
Back in the 70s in Greensboro, North Carolina, the dominant economic force was still textiles. For decades and decades, the mills were deeply segregated. Throughout the 1960s, almost all of the mill workers were white, except for the janitors. A labor organizer noted that the issue of race in the southern textile mills was so much more deep and so much more held to the core than it was up north in the auto plants.
But we finally got into the mills, and we were building up the union and bringing together black and white workers. That was the occasion of the North American Death Squad that took out five beautiful organizers, wounded 10 others, including myself, and left this community scarred and divided in ways that I would not have believed could have happened, but it did. And it's reminded me somewhat of the period we seem to be entering into.
That's Reverend Nelson Johnson, co-founder of the Beloved Community Center in Greensboro.
And this is Freedom Dreams, the show where we know another world is possible because we're talking to the people who are building it. I'm Amanda Alexander, founding executive director of the Detroit Justice Center.
And I'm Casey Rastro, communications director at DJC.
This season on Freedom Dreams, we're focusing on creative, holistic solutions to violence. So today, we're going to learn about a community-wide truth and reconciliation process that has been unfolding in Greensboro for over 40 years.
We think that there is a basis for human beings to change. And if I didn't think that, I wouldn't be involved in this. I often say I don't give this speech to alligators. They're not going to change, and I'd be wasting my time. I do think that humans can change, and we have to shift the conditions that make it possible for people who may be leaning toward change to want to actually walk toward each other in a way that holds redemptive possibilities for the nation.
Two people at the center of that process are Reverend Johnson and his wife and longtime co-captain, Joyce Johnson. They've been activists since the 1960s. They're so cool and brilliant and wise. In addition to running the Beloved Community Center in Greensboro, they also serve on the National Council of Elders, this badass group of movement luminaries from all over the country.
Yes, so powerful. I'm just so excited to have the Johnsons joining us on the show today to talk about really the long work of truth and reconciliation. Like so many discussions we've had on this show, today's episode really illustrates how change happens. It's plodding, often uncomfortable, but extraordinarily creative.
So the actual parade, the event that you were organizing was a Death to the Klan rally. What inspired you?
Let me correct you on one thing. That's the title that the police gave to the march, Death to the Klan. It was one of several slogans that we use. And we meant death to the ideology of the Klan, of racism. It was twisted into saying that we were trying to kill the Klan. We had no idea they were coming. But the idea was to march through the historical Black community where we were well known and well respected. And we had flyers
saying, join the conference. It really was a conference. And the conference was to discuss the imperative of building unity between the diversity of poor people, in particular between Black and poor white people, which were the primary people in the city of Greensboro in 1979.
But from the get-go, there was friction.
The first issue was that we had a very difficult time getting the parade permit. And we were coming up on the last days, had not received it. And I paid a visit to the police department several times, and they said, the person who handled this is out of town. That was stunning to me. How can the police department be out of town and somebody not be in charge of this piece? So I got it 2 days before the march. And unbeknown to me, they had given that parade permit to a Klan member who was also a police agent. He was informing on behalf of the police.
That police informant slash Klan member was a guy named Eddie Dawson. According to a commissioned report about the events from this time, quote, the role of Eddie Dawson as a police informant within the Klan exceeded that of a typical informant. Dawson made the initial racist, virulently anti-communist speech at the Klan rally designed to incite a confrontation with the Workers' Viewpoint Association. He arranged for the assembly point for Klan and Nazi members prior to going to the parade. He was in regular contact with Klan leader Virgil Griffin to discuss plans to disrupt the parade. He obtained a copy of the parade permit and route. He drove the route with Klansmen the night before the parade. He pointed out the route prior to leaving the Klan assembly point. End quote.
When I say the date, November 3rd, 1979, what's the first thing you think of?
My friends who were snatched away. I think about the terror that we personally experienced, but especially our 7 and 8-year-old daughters who were there. I think about the predominantly African-American poor public housing project where this happened. I think about our idealism of really merely bringing people together to understand how together, you know, the people united can never be defeated, just the slogans, the chants that we would say and sing. And I think about how that was so sharply arrested. So that's what comes to my mind. But first of all, those five dear, beloved friends.
On that day, when the caravan drove in, some shouting occurred and people jumped out of their vehicles and our people, got in the act of defending themselves. They fired a shot in the air and all the people rushed away from the shot toward the end of the caravan. When the trunk came up, they were actually running toward the arsenal of weapons in the trunk of that 8th car, and they opened fire on people. That was a tragic day. A Nazi tried to stab me in the midsection in my stomach. I blocked it. The knife went through my arm. I heard the gunshots. I didn't know where they were coming from, and I then discovered the bodies as the caravan drove away, and there was still no police there. There was one police car following them, but they stopped a long ways away and took pictures. It was a dastardly scene.
Five activists opposing the Klan were shot and killed that day. Cesar Vicente Caus, Michael Ronald Nathan, William Evan Sampson, Sandra Neely Smith, and Dr. James Michael Waller. A bunch more were injured, including Reverend Johnson.
Klan and Nazi members claimed self-defense and were acquitted of all criminal charges by all white juries twice.
After a quick break, truth and reconciliation.
We found out quickly that the truth nor reconciliation are welcome always.
Hello, I'm Sheba Rogers, and I'm the Divest Invest Senior Program Manager with the Detroit Justice Center and our Just Cities Lab. When people hear legal nonprofit, they probably think of attorneys in courtrooms fighting for clients. While we do plenty of that, my role involves navigating how policymakers in Lansing can better meet the needs of communities here in Detroit. One thing we're fond of saying at DJC is that incarceration is always a policy failure, and it's part of my job to help facilitate policy that decreases our reliance on police and prisons. Our supporters make what we do possible, and if you want to support our work, visit DetroitJustice.org/donate.
Over 20 years after the Greensboro Massacre, folks like Reverend Nelson and Joyce Johnson felt like there remained a tremendous amount of misunderstanding about what actually happened and why.
So we kept talking, and finally someone suggested to us, well, why don't you think about something like the truth process they did in South Africa? And we just said,
You are going to be a crippled community, whether you like it or not. You are going to be a crippled community as long as you refuse to face up to your past.
That's the voice of the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He traveled to Greensboro in the early 2000s to help consecrate the Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It was an independent body made up of seven highly respected individuals appointed through a democratic and community-wide nomination and selection process. The commission was the first of its kind in the United States.
The Johnsons weren't on the commission, but as integral members of the events of November 3rd, 1979, they were a big part of initiating the process.
May God provide this commission with the will, the insight, the vision, the sensitivity and caring to be that catalyst for truth, healing, and restorative justice in this community. What a blessed day.
We found out quickly that the truth, no reconciliation, are welcome always. Certainly not by those in power, but even some of us who suffer from lack of truth, we're just used to kind of moving along to get along. And when you delve into the truth, it's a dicey thing. As Alex Lorraine from South Africa said, the truth is bitter. It carries some hardships with it, but it is free, and we still believe that.
We will now bring this hearing to order. We thank everyone here for their willingness and openness to listen to the variety of viewpoints on traumatic events in our history.
We have this false understanding that the truth has hierarchy to it. So if it's on certain radio, TV station, or it comes from a certain professor or whatever like that, it's got to be more true than the truth. That the person who was sweeping the floor or cleaning the kitchen or, you know, taking care of the baby. I don't believe that. We didn't believe that. And history will show that's not true. There's some truth within all of us. We see it from different angles, but the thing is really being able to come together and evolve what we've named now community truth.
The mandate of the Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation Commission reflects that, quote, there comes a time in the life of every community when it must look humbly and seriously into its past in order to provide the best possible foundation for moving into a future based on healing and hope.
Because you can get stuck in a place, fighting back and hating what have you. But what motivates me, and I think most of, certainly I know Nelson, but most of our friends, is this deep love for people and a belief that people can change if first they try to, but also the right circumstances are put into place to make that happen. So a lot of work went into building this space. We really wanted Klan and Nazis to come back and speak. Folk didn't believe it would happen.
The reason I came to Greensboro, they put the poster out, death to the Klan, Said we was hiding under rocks. We were scum. I'm not scum. I'm as good as any man walks on this earth.
Can you talk a little bit about it, the reconciliation process itself? Because at that point, you sat in the same room as the Klansmen and family members of people who had been murdered. So can you just talk a little bit about what that was like and what did it, what, yeah, just take us inside of that room.
It was tension. It was anticipation. Some people were reliving, you know, some of those feelings we'd gone through because the widows were there, their children were there, attorneys were there and all that. But it mainly was a sense of possibility that we would get at the truth.
During the public hearing set up by the commission, 54 people spoke about how the Greensboro massacre impacted them.
Gunfire. Scrapes. Engines gunning as the shooters fled. An eerie silence. I could smell gunpowder in the air and heard the groaning of people who were dying.
You don't let two groups with extreme political views from each other come together without a buffer. And the buffer would have been the police. My opinion, yes, we should have been there.
As soon as the shooting stopped and I realized that people were injured, I searched for Caesar and I found him dead. And I immediately knew that we had been set up.
After November the 3rd, the police treated us like we had committed the crimes, like we had killed the communist workers on November the 3rd. We were put on curfew. There were helicopters. There was tons of police. We were in a war zone. We were treated like prisoners in our own community.
My two children saw their Auntie Sandy with a bullet between her eyes and blood streaming down her face. This scene was permanently burned into the consciousness of my little girls. And when I hear establishment apologists with glib arrogance promote the absolutely false view that I planned a shootout and then tricked the police, my blood boils as my soul rages.
You know, there are many people whose lives changed that day, changed to not trust in the system that's supposed to protect you, changed to, you know, a fear of many things, but my life never changed. It started that way.
Two years after the commission convened for the first time, the seven-member commission presents their findings.
On the morning of November 3rd, 1979, Klan and Nazi members headed for the parade starting point, intending to break the law, and came with an arsenal of weapons and heavy firearms. The heaviest burden of responsibility is on Klansmen and Nazis, who after an initial stick fight with demonstrators, returned to their cars, retrieved weapons, and fired at mostly unarmed demonstrators when the caravan's path of exit was cleared and they could have fled. We find that the Communist Workers' Party members did not seek or deserve to be killed. They did, however, underestimate the danger of taunting the Klan with provocative language and for beating on caravan cars with sticks. The primary contributor to the loss of life was the absence of police, which endangered the welfare of all involved, including residents of Morningside homes where the shootings took place. Nearly all commissioners believe that the police absence was the result of some intentionality on the part of at least some officers in the Greensboro Police Department. Paid police informant and Greensboro Klansman Eddie Dawson played a leadership role in bringing the Klan and Nazis into contact with the Communist Workers' Party. Despite knowledge of Dawson's actions and other intelligence that violence was likely, police made decisions to give Dawson a copy of the parade permit not to warn demonstrators about the supremacist plans, not to be anywhere near the scene, not to accompany the caravan in a noticeable way, not to monitor the situation using hand radios, and not to stop fleeing cars after the tragedy.
So the good news is that after 2 years of deliberations, they did come up with a thick 529-page document, a final report, that had in it several, over 20 recommendations.
Here are some of those recommendations. The city should formally recognize that the events of November 3rd, 1979 provided a tragic but important occasion in our city's history. It should make a proclamation that lifts up the importance of that date in the history of the city.
Individuals who are responsible for any part of the tragedy of November 3rd, 1979 should reflect on their role and apologize, publicly and or privately, to those harmed.
The Greensboro Historical Museum and the International Civil Rights Museum should work either collaboratively or independently to create exhibits commemorating the tragic shootings of November 3rd, 1979.
The religious leadership in Greensboro should plan and facilitate a healing workshop or retreat for the children of CWP members, shooters, and others directly involved in the events of November 3rd, 1979.
A public monument should be built on the site of the shootings to honor those killed and wounded on November 3rd, 1979.
All city and county employees should engage in anti-racism training.
The city should issue annual reports on race relations and racial disparities.
Those aren't all the recommendations, but that gives you a sense of the breadth and depth of what came out of the commission's report.
It's not like a panacea. It's not like it's all over, but at least gives you the falsehoods are taking down a lesson. And there's a platform from which those who are seeking truth, seeking justice, can continue to move.
Well, let me say that most of them are not being put into place. But the two most outstanding ones that have been put into place is a credible apology on behalf of the city, number one. Number two is that this should be taught in the classrooms. We do have a course now that's being promoted in the classroom. And number three is that a permanent marker needed to be put up on the site where this tragedy occurred. That has occurred.
It stands there in silence, a lone marker with fewer than 25 words to evoke the violence. To stand there on the corner of Dunbar and McConnell, it's hard to fathom the mayhem.
The sign reads, Greensboro Massacre, Ku Klux Klan members and American Nazis on November 3rd, 1979, shot and killed five Communist Workers' Party members, 1/10 mile north.
I think the main thing we want to make clear is that the recommendations were good. It kind of provided a collective platform for those who were justice seekers in the city and beyond the city. But none of the rectification or policy changes have come without still the continued work of the people in Greensboro who were engaged working for that justice.
This is a long struggle. After over 200 years of slavery and 100 years of lynch law, one event is not going to kick us out of this. But it was meaningful, and we're building on that. I joined with Bishop Tutu, who said when he helped us out, that I tremble for the United States because you don't know what you're dealing with underneath the shining lights. The glory that you give to democracy. Unless you face the truth of yesterdays, they will erupt in your face. And he said, I'm glad y'all are doing what you're doing. We recognize it as small, but significant.
I think it is significant. And one of the things that I was captivated by in this interview is the demand that the Klan not go back into Greensboro as it was like spitting on the graves of people who had been killed. And ultimately, both that moment of going to the Klan leaders and asking them not to come back to Greensboro and the Truth and Reconciliation process, both being examples of the insistence you have to have to make a process like this work in the first place, or for reconciliation to occur. I think without the demands, it would have been easy for all of this to be swept under the rug.
I was really struck by what Joyce said about coming together and evolving community truths. It makes me think of other examples where people have tried something similar. So I think of the Chicago Torture Justice Memorial and the fight to win reparations for survivors of police torture in Chicago. After many years of organizing and fighting to establish a community truth, people pushed the Chicago City Council to pass legislation for the first time in the U.S. to provide reparations for police torture survivors. The legislation included a formal apology for the torture. It required that Chicago public schools teach a history lesson about the police torture cases to 8th and 10th graders. It included counseling for the torture survivors and their families, free job training for survivors and their families, and a permanent public memorial. More recently, I think of the MPD 150 project in Minneapolis, a community-driven effort to produce a people's history and performance evaluation of the Minneapolis Police Department. The MPD 150 report was published in 2017 on the 150th anniversary of the MPD, and it aimed to change the story of policing in the city, and it set in motion a process for dissolving the police department. That community truth would feed directly into the organizing to dismantle the police department in the wake of George Floyd's murder by Officer Derek Chauvin 3 years later. So Truth Commissions, they're an imperfect tool. In South Africa, the TRC was rightly criticized because it gave commission members the power to grant amnesty to apartheid officials and other wrongdoers, but not the power to implement reparations. But it's a tool worth studying. It's worth understanding how different communities have adapted it, improved upon it, and made it a vehicle for achieving reparations and for seeking justice that is far more expansive than what U.S. courts can offer.
Because our nation now is teetering on the brink of even deeper division, unless some kind of measure can be brought to challenge the tsunami of falsehood that's washing over the nation, pitting people against each other, creating fear and growing violence, up to and including some people are fearing a civil war. I don't think it's out of the question, but I don't think it's inevitable. I think it depends on what we human beings do in relationship to the situation we find ourselves in.
Well, so the final question we have is, what are your freedom dreams? So when you think 150 years from now, what do you hope is the legacy of your work?
We have to get to the root, as Reverend Barber say, of the problem. And at the root, down beneath the surface manifestation and the many leaves on this tree, is several primary reasons for it. And I hope that not 100 years, but 10 years, and then 100, that we can be making progress on the root of the problem and not just papering over it for a city or for a year or two, and then we're worse off than we were before that.
But Love and Community really does sum it up for me. So that name means more than just a catchy name for us. It really is does speak to the present we're fighting hard for, but the future that we seek, and we see weaving together that future with all the other people and creatures that we share this earth with.
Freedom Dreams is a production of the Detroit Justice Center. Special thanks to our team, Zach Rosen, our producer.
The Freedom Dreams theme song is by Asante. Artwork is by Gunnar and Hobbs. If you want to learn more about today's episode, head to freedomdreamspodcast.com. Email us a voice memo of your freedom dream at freedomdreams@detroitjustice.org.
You can also write to us on social media. We're Freedom Dreams Pod on Instagram and Freedom Dream Pod on Twitter.
If you feel compelled to donate to the work we do, you can find us at detroitjustice.org/donate.
And finally, if you love this show and want us to find a wider audience, please leave us a rating or review at Apple Podcasts or Spotify.